Today, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer who faces up to 40 years in prison following the death of George Floyd. On May the 25th, last year, the world stood still as videos circulated of a man dying after a police officer restrained him by placing a knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes. The crossing of East 38th Street and Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis, where the incident took place, has come to be known as George Floyd Square.
There are the names of, I counted, at least 60 people that had been killed by police brutality leading up to the fist in the middle that's holding a Pan-African flag. There is a mural right outside of Cup Foods with messages of hope and freedom and justice, as well as flowers and candles. And, you know, while it is symbolic of community coming together to try to create something beautiful, it also is a mourning space, because as we've watched the trial, you know, we watched George Floyd die from essentially different angles from different bystander videos, and for a lot of people in the community that really hit home for them.
And it hit home for Umdulotta Jassa too, who is now writing about the impact of the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin for The Guardian, but who was then a student and a young black woman from Minneapolis.
This is my home city. This entire summer I was protesting almost every day. And when I tell you I was protesting, it wasn't like I went to one protest and then I went on with my merry life. I was going to two or three protests daily. That was my entire summer.
How hard is it for the community to watch this case take place?
You know, we want to watch this monumental case because it has such large implications. But at the same time, as people, especially black people, it's very hard to watch. I know personally, this makes me emotional even thinking about it, but I think about my brother. I think that that could be my stepdad, and that they could go out to the store and I could come back and I might not be able to see them again. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get emotional, but it just hits closer to home, and it's traumatizing to watch black bodies on social media and on mainstream media be taken, because you don't want that to become normalized. But in this case, it almost feels like it's necessary.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the world watches as Derek Chauvin is tried over the killing of George Floyd. Oliver Lachland, we've just been hearing from Amjila, who has been writing about the scenes outside the courtroom as Derek Chauvin is tried, and about the impact on her community. You've been writing about how things have been unfolding inside. You've reported on several high-profile police trials for The Guardian before, but nothing quite like this. It's been called one of the most consequential trials in American history. It's been running for more than a week now, and we're going to cover all the major developments. But can you start by taking us inside the courtroom? What's it like in there?
What did you see the officer...
So the fact that this is being live streamed for the general public to view gives everybody an insight into the proceedings as they happen. So you can see the prosecutors examining their witnesses.
George was motionless, limp, and Chauvin seemed very... He just rested his knee on his neck.
You're able to see Derek Chauvin in real time react as people testify against him. You're able to see his defense lawyer, Eric Nelson, cross-examine witnesses as well.
You described the crowd that they were yelling and screaming.
Correct.
As well as the really, really powerful testimony that we've had over the past week.
I don't have a mama either. I understand him.
It's really quite an extraordinary spectacle, and it's made even more extraordinary by the fact that anybody can watch it.
My mom died June 25th.
It's very important to say right at the start of this just how rare it is for any of these officer-involved fatalities to even make it to a criminal prosecution. law enforcement kill around 1,100 people in America every year, and a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of those make it to criminal prosecution.
And we're going to turn now to that landmark settlement in the George Floyd case.
And there's a backdrop to it, which would seem unusual, particularly to us here in the UK, where the rules around cases like this are very different. The city actually settled a civil case with the family over George Floyd's death just before the trial began.
The question, could it impact fired police officer Derek Chauvin's murder trial?
So one of the things that has made this proceeding relatively controversial, particularly from the eyes of defence, Chauvin's defence, is that the city settled a case with George Floyd's family for $27 million, accepting liability. And that, according to the defence anyway, led to a degree of prejudice against Chauvin. Obviously, the judge didn't agree with that. The defence were arguing that this case should be postponed, that the venue should be changed, and that hasn't happened.
And the other big question is, what is actually on trial? We all remember the 25th of May, of course. Police have been called to a convenience store. They arrested George Floyd over an alleged fake $20 note. We know exactly what happened next because we saw it. We watched George Floyd essentially narrate his own death, and we saw Derek Chauvin with a knee on his neck. We don't need to replay that. Anyone who would want to see that video has seen it. How have they chosen a jury to decide on this?
So the jury selection process has taken over a week to form. We now have 12 jurors there who actually represent a much more diverse panel of jurors than the city of Minneapolis itself. So 50% of jurors are black or multiracial. That's in comparison to just 17% of the city itself. And really on both sides, what you've seen during impaneling of this jury are prosecutors and defense lawyers trying to find people who they think can be impartial. That's obviously incredibly difficult in a high profile case like this, where pretty much all the jurors have admitted they know something about what happened between Chauvin and Floyd, many of whom have seen the video themselves. But we've come to a point now where, you know, I guess both sides are satisfied that they've got as impartial a jury as they're possibly going to get.
And so far, we've heard largely from prosecution witnesses, but the strategies of the two sides have already begun to emerge, and I just want to talk about them, starting with the prosecution. How is it approaching this case?
So the prosecution has made very, very clear to the jury right from the beginning of opening arguments that this case is a murder case.
In this 9 minutes and 29 seconds, you will see that as Mr. Floyd is handcuffed there on the ground, he is verbalizing 27 times, you will hear, in the 4 minutes and 45 seconds, "I can't breathe, please, I can't breathe."
It's not about any of the other forces that obviously George Floyd's death has come to symbolize. So there will be no discussion of systemic issues of racial bias in policing, for example. There'll be no discussion of racism more broadly in society. This is very clearly about the death of George Floyd, what caused it and who caused it. So you saw at the beginning, prosecutor Jerry Blackwell talk in a lot of detail about the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that Derek Chauvin held his knee on George Floyd's neck. And basically for them, that is the critical piece of evidence throughout this.
You will learn that Mr. Chauvin is told that they can't even find the pulse of Mr. Floyd. You learn he's told that twice. They can't even find the pulse. You'll be able to see for yourself what he does in response. You will see that he does not let up and that he does not get up.
The prosecution is obviously going to be relying on expert testimony from use of force experts, from members of the Minneapolis police themselves, to say that this was a disproportionate use of force that led directly to George Floyd's death. And as well as arguing that through video evidence, through expert testimony, they have a key document in this, which is the medical examiner's report that concluded that George Floyd's death was a homicide, a death that was caused by another human being, and it was caused by police restraint.
And is it clear yet how the defence is likely to respond?
So we're still waiting to sort of see the very detailed particulars of defence. We know from opening arguments that Chauvin's defence attorney, Eric Nelson, is going to argue that Chauvin used a proportionate amount of force.
The evidence will show that Mr. Floyd died of a cardiac arrhythmia that occurred as a result of hypertension, his coronary disease, the ingestion of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and the adrenaline flowing through his body.
He's going to argue that George Floyd was a combative arrestee. He's going to argue that Chauvin and the other three officers who were involved in this arrest felt threatened by the crowd of onlookers. And he's also going to argue that George Floyd's death was caused by an overdose, that George Floyd had battled opioid addiction, and that he had, according to the defense, ingested a number of pills before he was arrested, and this was the cause of his death.
All of which acted to further compromise an already compromised heart.
You mentioned the onlookers, and of course they're going to be incredibly important to this case because it did have a huge number of eyewitnesses, right from the cashier who called the police in the first place and who told the court he felt disbelief and guilt for doing that over the fake note. But there were many others, weren't there, who actually watched the scene play out on the street itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you think about past cases that have officer-involved deaths, there's not often a huge amount of eyewitnesses that can be called to testify.
And ask you a few questions about your video going viral.
There's a huge amount of eyewitness testimony in this trial, which makes it powerful for prosecutors, because what you've seen is a real consensus amongst people who watch this that this was an overuse of force, that they were pleading with Chauvin and other officers to take his knee off the neck. And really, some of the most vivid testimony has come from some of the younger people who witnessed this. So Donella Fraser, who was 17 at the time this happened, is the woman who took that now infamous video of George Floyd dying under Chauvin's knee. And she gave some incredibly powerful, vivid testimony, talking not only about what she saw, but the effect that it had on her as well.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
I think any jury listening to that sort of argument is obviously going to take that very seriously.
And people weren't just standing and watching, were there? Despite the fact that these were police officers, some of those actually called 911 to report what they were seeing.
He just pretty much just killed this guy that wasn't resisting arrest. He had his knee on the dude's neck the whole time.
So a number of those bystanders called 911. In the words of the prosecutor, called the police on the police as they were witnessing what was happening.
It didn't take me long to realize that he had an altered level of consciousness. And in our training, that is when the first sign that somebody needs medical attention.
Genevieve Hansen was an off-duty first responder and was amongst the crowd of people who watched this happen and said that she tried to intervene to offer medical assistance to Mr. Floyd, but was rebuffed by the officers who were restraining him.
Why weren't you able to do any of that?
Because the officers didn't let me in to the scene.
And the people who were calling 911 had a strong view on what they were seeing.
Oh yeah, that's become very clear throughout this trial that most of the people who were witnessing this were appalled by what they saw. Donald Williams, who is another one of those bystanders, described saying that he believed he witnessed a murder.
Did you make a 911 call?
That is correct. Did call the police on the police.
What was very interesting about Mr. Williams' testimony was the way in which he was cross-examined by the defense. So you can hear Donald Williams on that eyewitness video talking to the officers as they're restraining George Floyd, obviously remonstrating with them about the use of force that they're using.
Bro, the man ain't moved yet, bro. Okay.
Where? Minneapolis!
Okay. Bro, okay. You're a bum, bro. Okay. You're a bum, bro.
Under cross-examination, Donald Williams was asked a lot about his use of language, and I think that is obviously the defense trying to build up this picture that the officers were facing a hostile crowd and that they were, you know, essentially trying to do their best in a hostile situation. But obviously, Donald Williams is his own man and was able to push back and say, you're going to try and characterize me as angry. I wasn't angry.
You grew angrier and angrier.
No, I grew professional and professional. I stayed in my body. You can't paint me out to be angry.
We've spoken about people just walking by that day, but there were a number of emergency responders who were directly involved in this case who have been giving evidence, right through from the woman who took the original 911 call. How was she an eyewitness?
So Jenna Scurry was the 911 dispatcher involved in fielding some of these calls, and she was able to watch what was happening on a trained camera, a CCTV camera, operated by the Minneapolis Police Department. She thought that the video feed had actually frozen because the officers were on top of him for such a long time.
What did you think about this when you looked back and saw that it hadn't changed?
I first asked if the screens had frozen.
She was so concerned by what she saw that she actually called a supervising sergeant at the Minneapolis Police Department to let them know that something was going wrong.
There just something wasn't right. I don't know how to explain it. It was a gut instinct to tell me that now we can be concerned.
Really underlines what the prosecution are trying to get at here with the bystander and eyewitness testimony, that this was an overuse of force, disproportionate use of force, and incredibly shocking and disturbing to anybody, either an expert or a non-expert, watching it.
And what about medical help that was sent to the scene?
So a number of the paramedics who initially attended to the scene testified that as soon as they got there, it became pretty clear that George Floyd was unresponsive.
I was standing a little ways away, so I couldn't get him. You know, my partner would have a more accurate description of his condition at that point, but from what I could see where I was at, I didn't see any breathing or movement or anything like that.
They eventually checked for a pulse. They couldn't find one. And in fact, even in some of the body camera video that the jury have been shown, you can hear one of the officers alerting Chauvin to the fact that Floyd doesn't have a pulse. They check it while he's in restraint, and they keep him in that restraint even after hearing that from one of the officers.
And beyond everything you've told me about bystanders and medical responders is something the prosecution has that is going to be incredibly difficult for Chauvin. And that is that he does not have the support of his own police force. He and three other officers were immediately fired from their jobs. And now the jury has been hearing from other officers. What has been said?
Have you ever, in all the years you've been working for the Minneapolis Police Department, been trained to kneel on the neck of someone who is handcuffed behind their back in a prone position?
No, I haven't.
The prosecution is building a really comprehensive argument by getting a number of senior officers from the Minneapolis Police Department to testify against their former colleague. We have seen the department's most senior and experienced officer, Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, who heads the homicide division, describing the force that Derek Chauvin used.
What is your, your view of that use of force during that time period?
Totally unnecessary.
And on Monday, we saw the police chief, the chief executive officer of the Minneapolis Police Department, Madaria Arredondo, testifying against Derek Chauvin, taking to the stand for a number of hours and essentially repeating what his colleagues have already said, that this was a violation of use of force for a number of reasons. Firstly, the use of the restraint in the first place and the fact that it did not stop after George Floyd stopped resisting, and the fact that the officers did not administer medical aid to him when it became clear he was in distress.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, it is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
When you compare even the fact that the chief is testifying for the prosecution in this case to other cases, other officer-involved cases that have made it trial, it's certainly not something that I have seen in my time covering police violence in America, and it's certainly not something that a number of experts that I have spoken to, former police chiefs themselves, people who have been involved in police reform efforts around the country, have ever seen. And I think what we saw on Monday, see an officer of that level of seniority taking the stand, taking really a stand against one of his own officers and working with the prosecution to try and secure a conviction, was quite extraordinary.
And surely it's very, very difficult for the defence. How can they argue that Chauvin was just doing his job if none of his superiors accept that?
So what I expect you are going to see, and judging from the witness list, is that you're going to get other use of force experts who have testified in defence of other police officers involved in fatal violence in other trials, to come and testify and say that this was a proportionate and necessary use of force to restrain George Floyd. When Zimmerman faced cross-examination, he was asked about how long he had been in the department for. He was referred to by the defense as a quote-unquote old-school cop, essentially suggesting that some of his evidence may have been outdated. I don't know how much of a strong defense that is, but that's certainly the argument they're trying to go for.
What, that more force is used these days than in the past?
That the training that he received when he joined the force was different to what other officers may have received later on. That essentially Zimmerman and other senior officers who have testified are now sort of desk job policemen. They're not the ones out on the streets policing day to day.
So essentially, it sounds like what the defence is going to try to do is to turn each of these situations around on the witnesses themselves, whether it was the onlookers who they're trying to depict as aggressive and suggest that perhaps that would have affected how Chauvin had behaved, or in this case, senior police officers who they're trying to depict as being out of date with the training that police officers like Chauvin would have gone through today. But presumably, the other person that they want to turn this around onto is George Floyd himself, and in particular, whether drugs could have contributed to his death. Do we know what the argument will be on that?
We expect that George Floyd himself at some point is going to come under, you know, significant scrutiny as an individual, particularly his battle with addiction. And what we saw from the prosecution was an attempt to kind of get out in front of this by calling Floyd's girlfriend, Courtney Ross.
He asked me if he could get my number, and we had our first kiss in the lobby.
What kind of drug use was a part of that relationship?
She said that they both got hooked on opioids when they had been prescribed painkillers for chronic pain. And that's really a story that you hear all around America. There's a sort of epidemic in this country of opioid addiction all across the country.
Classic story of how many people get addicted to opioids. We both suffered from chronic pain.
Under cross-examination, Courtney Ross was asked to talk in more detail about the couple's addiction issues, was asked about whether George Floyd had ever taken heroin, and also about an alleged overdose episode a number of months prior to his death. The prosecution have argued in court George Floyd had built up a significant tolerance to opioids and to certain drugs, which is why that even though the autopsy shows that there were traces of drugs in his system, they argue very clearly that this was not the cause of his death. That is not the cause of action that the defense are going to take. They are going to argue that very directly the drugs in his system were a significant cause of his death.
Given how traumatizing this all is, not just for those involved, but as we were hearing from Amjila, for the whole community, isn't it going to cause fury if the defence try to put George Floyd on trial?
Absolutely. And there are two kind of audiences for this trial, if we think about it really. There's the audience inside the courtroom and the people who are going to have to come to a decision over guilt in this case. And then there is also the viewing public. And what you've already begun to see is very, very direct criticism of the defence strategy already, which is, in a sense, blaming George Floyd for his own death.
And has the judge had anything to say on that?
Before the trial began, there were a number of hearings for certain pieces of background evidence, really, to be admitted in court. Initially, the judge had ruled that anything to do with George Floyd's previous interaction with law enforcement should not be admissible. But actually, Judge Cahill is now allowing a small amount of evidence from a 2019 arrest involving Mr. Floyd to be used by defense attorneys. Prosecutors are also able to talk about a number of use of force incidents involving Derek Chauvin. But there's no doubt to my mind that if the defense goes down that route and introduces evidence involving a separate incident of George Floyd's interaction with law enforcement, that will obviously cause outrage, not least of all George Floyd's family members, who have said, as you say, that George Floyd is not on trial here. It's Derek Chauvin who's on trial.
Coming up, what would it mean if Derek Chauvin is not found guilty of the killing of George Floyd? Ollie, we know this is a murder trial, but it is never quite that simple. What charges is Chauvin actually facing, and what level of proof is going to be needed?
So Chauvin is facing three separate charges, all related to this one incident. So if Chauvin is found guilty of second-degree murder, he faces up to 40 years in prison. If he's found guilty of third-degree murder, he faces a maximum sentence of 25 years. And if he's found guilty of manslaughter, it's 10 years. And really underpinning the differences in all of these charges is the level to which prosecutors can prove the intentionality behind his actions.
We begin with the headline breaking this afternoon in that South Carolina courtroom in the case of former police officer Michael Slager, the mistrial now declared.
And one critical thing to remember about all these charges is the need for a unanimous decision on guilt or non-guilt. And what you've seen in other cases, officer-involved cases that have made it to trial, and sometimes cases where you think the evidence is clear-cut. So I'm thinking clearly here of the Walter Scott case, where there was that eyewitness video back in 2015 of Michael Slager shooting Walter Scott from behind as he ran away.
That video that sent shockwaves, Scott running off after being stopped for a broken taillight, Slager chasing after him.
That case actually resulted in a mistrial because the jury was not unanimous on the decision of whether Michael Slager murdered Walter Scott. It was an 11-1 deadlock. And that, you know, it's impossible to say, possible to know exactly what all these jurors are thinking, but that's a very real possibility.
And it's not just him, is it? Others are also being placed on trial for Floyd's death.
So when this trial finishes, Minneapolis will go through another set of trials for the three other officers that attended to the arrest, who are all charged with aiding and abetting and also of manslaughter as well. And those trials are scheduled to occur in August.
George Floyd's death was about so much more than one man. It triggered a movement that wasn't just US-wide, it was global, and it's still reverberating today. Similarly, Derek Chauvin's trial is not going to be seen as something that just relates to one man or a small group of officers, is it? You've covered cases like this before. How important are their outcomes for the communities that exist far beyond just the families of the victims?
I think this case means so many things to so many different people, and it's almost impossible for me to try and quantify that in any answer I can give you. Some of the activists that I've spoken to basically say that a guilty verdict in this case is a shred of justice and nothing more. It's not going to bring back George Floyd. It will not right the wrongs, the many historic wrongs that this case points to, and it will not lead to widespread and whole-scale reform of US policing, let alone policing just in Minneapolis. But I think when you listen to some of the lawyers and the family members of George Floyd who talk about this and talk about this case, they say that they are expecting something that is not extraordinary at all. They are expecting equal justice under the law. And I think for many people, a guilty verdict in this case will be just that.
Oliver Lachland, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Anushka.
That was Oliver Lachland and Umdulot Ajasa. Do follow their reporting and the rest of our Guardian US team on this trial at theguardian.com. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Palama Kaufman. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.